Start off with the director of the agency, Corey. Would you like to come on up?
Thank you.
Come on up. If you could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And on my right is Greg Malkasian, the Deputy Director. And, of course, you know Satish Upadhyay from the Department of Administrative Services. And I want to apologize in advance. I am still recovering from a cold, so if I end up drinking water in the middle of the presentation, I assume you would prefer that to a coughing fit. So I apologize in advance. I'm going to be presenting a brief overview of our agency's mission and programs to start with. Mr. Malkasian is then going to briefly review our revenue structure, and then we'll have each of our division administrators to discuss their programs in a little more detail. We then expect to come back to you with a discussion of our performance measures and how we have prioritized our programs in light of the outcomes that we achieve. And we understand during this first phase of your work, you're interested in focusing on prioritization. We have tried to tailor our presentation to that need and to describe to you what we deliver for the dollars you authorize us to spend. But if you do want more detail in any of our program areas, please let us know as we're going through this.
Well, Corey, what I'm going to hope is that Robin was sharing with me that you're going to be with us for 4 days.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that in 3 days we can really try and muscle through this and then have the final day for a real good opportunity for questions and answers. So I'm going to ask our committee to hold their questions unless there's something very pressing and to perhaps ask them towards the end. And if you have a question that really, really probes down into the agency, I'd ask that you would visit with the folks personally and feel free to come back to us with the question and the solution that was given to you. So with that said, go ahead.
Thank you very much. And I believe you have presentation materials in front of you. I, of course, won't be covering everything in those materials, but a lot of what I will be covering is also, there is some material related to it in the agency overview tab of your notebook. The Department of Consumer and Business Services, as I think you know, is Oregon's largest business regulatory agency. We administer state laws and rules to protect consumers and workers in the areas of workers' compensation, occupational safety and health, financial services and institutions, insurance, building codes, and contracting opportunities for emerging minority and women-owned businesses. And we also lead the governor's regulatory streamlining initiative. We are an other-funded agency. We receive no general fund appropriation. Our revenues come from approximately 500 different fees and assessments, which are paid by the industries we regulate and are statutorily dedicated to specific programs. Our mission, which you will see reflected on page 4 of the materials, is to protect and serve Oregon's consumers and workers while supporting a positive business climate in the state. And we don't view those as opposites or alternatives, but rather as complementary. In our view, a good regulatory system is one that protects consumers and workers and is also business friendly. We have 3 overall department goals: to protect consumers and workers, to regulate in a manner that supports a positive business climate, and to be accountable to the public we serve with excellent service to our customers. Our programs support 4 of the governor's budget principles. Public safety, which is defined to include providing for safe buildings and places of work and prevention of fraud and abuse, and that's a lot of what we do. Economic development, a positive business climate in order to create and retain sustainable businesses and family wage jobs. Health. And finally, government efficiency and accountability. With these goals in mind, I'd like to just very briefly review how we go about achieving our goals, our strategies or approaches, if you will. We have a lot of different subject matters in our agency, but we try to take a consistent approach to how we do our work. You'll see some of this on page 5 of the materials. But basically, we try to focus on areas where there are real concerns rather than theoretical problems, and we work to improve outcomes rather than just process. We structure our regulatory programs to minimize the burden on regulated businesses, consistent with the outcomes we're trying to achieve. We use a variety of approaches. In some cases, that may mean education, training, and consultation. In other cases, it's regulation and enforcement. Basically, we believe that most businesses want to hold themselves to high standards and comply with the law, and our goal as a regulator is to make sure the standards are clear, to help businesses understand how to comply, and, of course, to use our enforcement powers to ensure compliance when necessary. In many instances, education and consultation are just as important as regulation and enforcement. We try to make very good use of technology to make it easy to do business with us. We focus a lot of attention on customer service, and we try to have a problem-solving attitude. We look for ways to measure whether our programs and approaches are achieving the right results, and I know that's an area of great interest to you as well. Our goal is to make sure that our services are providing value to consumers, workers, and businesses. And finally, of course, our ability to deliver our programs depends on our employees and our ability to make sure that our employees have the resources they need to do their jobs. So over the course of the next couple of days, hopefully you will see these themes reflected in the presentations about specific programs that you hear. I'd like to go through our programs in broad detail. We are organized into five major divisions and a number of smaller programs. The major divisions are Workers' Compensation, Oregon OSHA, Building Codes Division, Insurance, and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And as I mentioned, you will be hearing separate presentations from the administrators of each of those areas. The first two divisions, Workers' Compensation and Oregon OSHA, are of course closely related. Both of them are major components of our workers' compensation system. The goals of Oregon OSHA are to improve workplace health and safety and to reduce the incidence of workplace illnesses and injuries. The major functions in Oregon OSHA are to inspect work sites for safety and health violations. We focus on high-hazard industries and those places of work where workers are more likely to be injured or exposed to hazards. We investigate workplace fatalities and major accidents. We respond to safety and health complaints. We provide consultation, training, and technical services for employers and employees, and we run safety and health recognition programs for employers who meet high standards for managing their own safety programs. And then, of course, we address workplace safety and health hazards through regulations which need to comply with federal minimums. So that's how those are the functions that are addressed toward keeping workers from being injured on the job. If a worker is injured, then the goal of our Workers' Compensation Division is to ensure that the worker receives the benefits and protections which the workers' compensation system provides. We do that by, first of all, we work on ensuring that employers maintain workers' compensation coverage, either through insurance or self-insurance, to protect their employees. We want to ensure that workers receive accurate and timely benefits, and that they receive quality medical care. We do this by certifying and monitoring managed care organizations, resolving medical disputes, and developing medical fee schedules. We facilitate early return to work for injured workers. We offer alternative dispute resolution, and we provide consultation and technical assistance, and we also reimburse for retroactive and supplemental benefits from our workers' benefit fund. Many of you are probably familiar with the way in which our workers' compensation system affects Oregon's economy. We've experienced a record 15 years of declining or flat workers' compensation premium rates, and our low rates have become a major recruiting tool in attracting businesses to Oregon, particularly, I might say, in comparison to California, even despite their recent massive efforts to change their system. At the same time, we have been able to deliver benefits to injured workers comparable to those in other states, and in fact, those benefits have been increasing in recent years. The biggest impact on keeping workers' compensation rates low has been an improvement in workplace health and safety, in which Oregon OSHA, of course, plays a critical role, and you'll be hearing more about that during the OSHA presentation. Another significant factor has been an improvement in our ability to get injured workers back to work quickly. Successful return to work programs benefit both workers and employers, and you'll be hearing more about these programs in the Workers' Compensation Division program, as well as the other ways that we help make this system work well. Our next major division is the Building Codes Division. Building Codes is responsible for the administration of building codes for residential and commercial construction statewide. Our goals are to ensure safe building construction while supporting a positive business climate. We do this by adopting and administering uniform statewide building codes that is not the case in a number of other states which have local building codes. We certify inspectors and we license construction trade professionals. We provide building code and rule interpretation. We provide dispute resolution and oversight of local government building departments. As you may know, we share permitting and inspection jurisdiction with local governments. Local governments can opt to provide those services themselves. We are the provider of last resort in several areas. We also take appropriate enforcement action in response to license, code, and permit violations. And as I mentioned, we provide inspections and permits where local government does not do so. Fundamentally, the success of our building code system is measured by the safety of buildings constructed in Oregon. I hope, and I'm sure you hope, that we will never have a major tsunami or a major earthquake that tests our building codes. But on a more day-to-day level, we can, in fact, test the efficiency of our system by how easy it is to use by developers and construction contractors who are fundamental to Oregon's economy, and we try to ensure statewide consistency. We try to ensure a user-friendly system so that construction contractors and developers can move ahead with their project efficiently and without unnecessary barriers. So when you hear from our Building Codes Division, you will hear more about how we try to accomplish all of those goals.
Senator Carter.
Mr. Eisinger, can you tell me in the case when they're doing building housing up on the coast, for instance, and what really comes to mind is the former governor and U.S. Senator Hatfield's house, that when it was built on faulty land base. Now, what does the state do in the event something like that happens versus the local community? Obviously, somebody okayed it for the house to be built. And so what happens in cases of that nature?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to answer that question specifically. The issues about surveying and placement of the building are not ones that the building codes specifically cover, but I can see if we can get back to you with anything more specific on that.
So building codes, you're saying, would not have anything to
with the underlying soils? And I'm not familiar with the specific situation. I know there have been some issues on the coast where the issue has been subsidence of the soil underneath.
Right.
Is that the situation?
Right. So who would give them a permit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, the local jurisdiction would give them the building permit in that area. But I'm going to have to get back to you on the issue of how the land use and location responsibilities are distinguished from the issues about the physical construction of the building.
Right. Because, Mr. Shepard, the reason I was asking that question, we have areas, as you know, in the early 60s was one of the Vancouver flood. Now, it's just terrible. So now we have 500-year plans. And so when anybody is going to in less than 500 years as well. But when someone is going to build in a particular area that was once a part of that flooding, you know it. And that if you continue to want to build in that area, you do it at your own risk. Or either they just, the city comes along and say that you cannot build in this area because of it being wetlands or something of that nature. And I was just wondering, how could someone build a house like that? Wouldn't the building codes have said this is not, a reputable, lack of another word, place to be building, so therefore we discourage it?
And Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I know there are areas which are unbuildable, but you have gotten beyond my level of technical ability to answer your question. But I can promise you we will provide you with an answer.
Let me tell you what Senator Hatfield said.
Oh, I can imagine.
Senator Morse.
And yes, Senator Morse may be able to answer
that. That's right. I love it.
Having in my former life been involved in some of these kinds of issues, the Corps of Engineers establishes floodplains. Mm-hmm. Those floodplain maps are used by local jurisdictions to determine what's buildable and what's not. As a general rule of thumb, we don't allow building in floodplains except for maybe floating structures in the case of, in the Portland area, you do have houseboats and those kinds of things. In terms of natural hazards, it's incumbent upon the local jurisdiction to make sure that when they approve, that has been properly investigated. And in some cases, it's unknown, as the case up in Washington. they just started sliding.
Oh, that's right.
Didn't realize they had a fault and a slip plane, and so huge subsidence. But generally, it's the local jurisdiction that will look at those issues.
And just to add to that, traditionally, when properties are in floodways or floodplains, you can build it, but it just requires flood insurance offered through FEMA. So it happens all the time. Anyway, we're going to get back on track.
Ms. Chair, I stand educated. In any event, unless there are other questions about building codes specifically, I'd like to turn to insurance, which is the next of our major divisions. And as you can see, there are interrelationships between these. The existence of flood insurance, the existence of other types of insurance obviously also relate to the quality of the structures. The goals of the insurance division are to ensure the financial soundness of insurers and the availability and affordability of insurance and the fair treatment of the insurance buying public. We monitor the solvency of insurance companies and intervene with that when that solvency is threatened. Our goal there is to ensure that for the insurance buying public, when you have purchased insurance, you want it to be there to respond to the risk. We review insurance and products and rates charged by insurance companies. We license insurance agents and brokers, who are now called producers under current law. We resolve consumer complaints. We monitor the overall conduct of insurance companies in the market, and we enforce the provisions of the insurance code for the protection of the public, and we try to educate the public about insurance issues. Insurance is something that we tend to take for granted. We tend to think that it's going to be available when we need to buy it, and we expect fair treatment and prompt handling of claims when we have a loss. And our challenge in the insurance department, given that the insurance market is national and is subject to national trends and a number of different factors, is to make sure that we do maintain the standards for fair treatment, but also to try to help make sure we have a vigorous insurance market so that Oregonians can buy insurance when they need it, and that sometimes can be a challenge. Our insurance division presentation is going to discuss in more detail how we go about meeting those challenges. In our Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is the last of our major programs, the goals are somewhat similar. Our goal there is to encourage a wide variety of financial services and products and information for Oregonians. We want to make sure that those products are provided in a safe, sound, equitable, and fraud-free manner as well. We oversee state-chartered banks and credit unions and financial services like consumer finance companies, pawnbrokers, mortgage lenders, money transmitters, payday and title lenders. We regulate securities offerings. We take enforcement action against illegal or fraudulent activity in the areas we regulate. And we promote investor and consumer education so that the public can recognize and avoid fraud and can also avoid products and services that are inappropriate to their financial goals and needs. And as in the area of insurance, our challenge is to make sure that Oregonians do have access to the financial products and services they need, but also that those products and services are delivered fairly and safely so that the financial security of our consumers and businesses are not put at risk. I mentioned that we have a number of smaller programs as well, in addition to these five major program areas. Although they are small from a budgetary standpoint, they play very important roles. The first is the Office of Regulatory Streamlining that works with all state business regulatory agencies to simplify regulations and improve customer service. Regulatory streamlining is a key focus for our agency as well. We have several dozen streamlining projects underway. You'll be hearing more about some of them. And this office helps share best practices and coordinate efforts throughout state government. The Oregon Medical Insurance Pool is a health insurance pool providing coverage for Oregonians who are unable to obtain coverage in the private market, either because they do not have other portability options available to them and they're eligible for portability coverage, or because their medical conditions is such that they're not able to be insured in the private market, for example, if they have cancer or AIDS and don't have group options available. Our Office of Minority, Women, and Emerging Small Businesses certifies businesses who meet state and federal criteria under state and federal law to provide them with increased contracting opportunities. We also have two ombudsman programs that are related to workers' compensation. the Ombudsman for Injured Workers, and the Small Business Ombudsman. And finally, we provide administrative and financial services for the Workers' Compensation Board, although programmatically it's an independent agency reporting to the board chair, and the board chair will be discussing that their programs during her presentation. We have two shared services divisions, the Information Management Division, which provides technology system support and research and analysis, and our Business Administration Division, which provides accounting, budgeting, purchasing, and facility support. The Director's Office, in addition to myself and Mr. Malkasian and our staff, also includes two shared service programs. They are Office of Personnel Services and our Communications Office, which coordinates internal and external communications, including our public information and education materials. We find that sharing these services allows us to take advantage of economies of scale, and it provides each of our divisions with access to a higher degree of expertise in those specialized areas. And you'll be hearing some of the specifics of what we are accomplishing in those areas later on.
Does economy of scales mean that they share in terms of the purchasing of materials for each of their offices, or explain that for me, Corey?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Carter, it means several things. First of all, we do actually do a lot of our purchasing through the DAS centralized purchasing system as well, so we get economies of scale that way. The Smart Buy program, which DAS has been working on, ensures that many agencies can get the benefits of negotiated prices. But shared services helps us in other ways. For example, we have been doing a focus on customer service training this biennium, and that has some elements which are unique to particular divisions. Customer service can mean something different for an OSHA compliance officer or a building codes inspector than it means for an insurance consumer advocate. But there are also elements which are common. So by having that training developed centrally, we can both be division specific but also share the elements that we need to share.
Thank you.
In addition to those shared services within our agency, and this relates to Senator Carter's question, we also work with other agencies to coordinate our services. And, of course, some of those are coordinated through DAS, like the Smart Buy project. Another example coordinated through DAS, we are a participating agency in the Scenic project to consolidate state data centers. The Office of Regulatory Streamlining, which I mentioned, works with many state agencies as well as our stakeholders to look for streamlining opportunities statewide, not only within individual agencies but also multi-agency projects, and also shares best practices among agencies. Some other examples, we work with the Construction Contractors Board. We have several areas of overlap. We have been coordinating with the Construction Contractors Board through our insurance division to work on some of the challenges that the construction industry has been facing in obtaining liability insurance. We've also coordinated with our building codes division through some legislative authority that this body granted last session. We are able to coordinate our enforcement activities and disciplinary actions much better with the Construction Contractors Board. We are engaged with the Department of Revenue, the Employment Department, and the Secretary of State on a project for a combined business registry. The goal is to allow a business to register once with the state and then have that data shared as needed with multiple agencies and ultimately, hopefully, with licensing agencies on a larger scale. We have been working with DAS IRMD, we are piloting a set of software products known as License 2000 and My License.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Can you share with us what that acronym stands for?
I'm sorry.
IRMD.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chair. If you're fining for acronyms, I owe you.
No, we're not. We just need a little help here.
I believe it is Information Resources and Management Division. It is the division within the Department of Administrative Service that focuses on information technology issues.
Thank you.
And in this case, this specific project, they have agreed that we are an appropriate lead agency because we have extensive licensing functions. So what we are doing is piloting a set of software products for online license issuance and renewal. We're piloting that initially with 5 licenses within our agency. Ultimately, we expect it to be usable for 80 different licenses. But what we are also doing is working with other agencies so that they can learn from our efforts. We're essentially sharing our learning, and we also negotiated an enterprise, statewide enterprise-based contract so that that product can be used by other agencies as well. And it may end up, depending on how things work out, that we may end up hosting some of the other agency functions in that regard. We work with the Bureau of Labor and Industries in a number of areas. Safety of farm worker housing, investigation of discrimination complaints by injured workers or those who complain about workplace safety are a couple of examples. And we regularly team up with the Department of Justice in some enforcement areas, securities enforcement, other financial fraud issues, some insurance issues. So that is a very high-level general overview of our programs. And after you've heard from our administrators about the programs in somewhat more detail, our plan is for me to come back and then review the prioritization of programs with you. I thought, though, it might be useful before we get into the specific programs to talk to you just very briefly about the criteria that we have used for prioritizing so that you can have those criteria in mind as you hear the substantive presentations from the different program areas. And, of course,
Senator Verger,
just
please.
A quick question before you leave the overview. Are you planning on leaving the overview now?
I am, Senator.
Yes. Where in the department are the people who do your collections, that collect for the money that is owed to you? Because a lot of your department is generated by those funds.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that function is within one of our shared services units. It's our business administration department, and it does collect for the accounts receivable for the entire department. And in that area, we've actually made some very significant strides this last biennium, thanks in part to some additional tools that again, were given to us by the legislature last session. We obtained warrant authority, which we've been using very effectively. The largest area of accounts receivable that we have is in the workers' compensation area for what are called non-complying employer claims. And those are employers who broke the law and did not obtain workers' compensation insurance for their workers. If the worker's injured, they're still entitled to benefits. And we advance the funds for those benefits from our worker benefit fund, and then we go after the employer. Mm-hmm. Now, sometimes we can't find them. Sometimes they're out of business. But where we can, we do. And this warrant authority has been extremely useful. Our collections for the first 18 months of this biennium are up over 7% higher than the equivalent 18-month period last biennium, and we're expecting that to improve.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Corey, am I to understand that it's not in each department? In other words, the collection is not necessarily in the workman's comp part of the agency. It's in the shared revenues?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that's correct. It's in the shared services area.
Services, yeah. Okay.
Again, because we can achieve economies of scale that way.
Okay.
Madam Director, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit, and I don't expect an answer today, but last session I went through my notes, and I had made a comment that I wanted to see this agency work much more closely with the small business development centers. And so over the course of your reviews or in the coming days, can you share with me how you folks have partnered with the small business development centers over the last 2 years?
Mr. Chair, we will get back to you.
Thank you. Let's move on.
So unless there are other questions about the overview, I did want to talk very briefly about our prioritization criteria. And again, these may not be your criteria, but we wanted to let you know how we approach the process. And of course, it's a challenge because, as you can see from the overview, our program areas are very diverse. Each of them does have a unique funding source. Each of them has stakeholders and interests that vary, but we know that's the challenge that you have to face as well. So we started by dividing our programs into 3 broad tiers. Tier 1 consists of those programs which, in our view, best meet the department's mission of protecting and serving consumers and workers and promoting a positive business climate. These are programs which directly support the governor's budget principles. They serve a broad spectrum of Oregon's population, and for the most part, these are also programs where we have measurable and demonstrable indicators of success. Our Tier 2 programs tend to be those which support a smaller segment of the population, but they are also ones that support our mission and the governor's budget principles. Our Tier 3 programs actually fall into two categories. Some of these programs serve very small populations and sometimes do not have measurable results. And other programs in this area, while are very important to be performed, could potentially be performed by entities other than state government, either at the local level or potentially by the private sector. So within each of these tiers, then, we prioritized further, and based on several factors. First, we looked at how serious would the harm be if we're not providing this function. And second, we asked how many Oregonians are affected. Programs which broadly protect life and safety rank highest for us, followed by those which broadly protect financial security, then those that provide services and assistance. Obviously, these are subjective factors. And again, we'll go through this in more detail with respect to each of our programs after you've heard the administrators' presentations, but again, we wanted to just lay out for you how we're approaching this project. So unless you have further questions at this point, our plan would be for Mr. Malkasian, the deputy director, to briefly summarize our revenue structure and then introduce the workers' compensation system and move directly into the program presentations.
Please. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Malkasian, as Corey said, and I am the deputy director of DCBS for the record. We thought that in this phase of the budget hearings, it would probably be most helpful for you to get kind of the 30,000-foot view of the budget, and we have some pie charts in the budget overview section of your presentation document that depict and give you a picture of how our budget as well as our revenues are allocated, both in the non-limited and the limited areas. As a matter of fact, the first page of that section shows the area of the budget that is non-limited, and that is the largest area. And those are the direct service benefits to Oregonians and the monies that go for the cost of those benefits. The smaller shaded portion of the budget is what the actual cost of providing the administration is, and that's the limited portion of our budget. The next page is a good depiction on page 2 of the operating budget, so you can get a perspective of how much money and how much FTE are going to each of the areas that Corey went over in the overview of each of the divisions. The next page after that, page 3, is the DCBS non-limited budget. And these show the amount of monies that basically go out in two different areas. The larger portion on the right is those monies that go out for medical insurance benefits and third-party administrative costs in the Oregon Medical Insurance Program. And that's based upon a range of what our anticipated or expectations of those costs are over the next 2 years. And you can imagine that's a real challenge to target what that exact cost is. And so we try to target what we think the high end probably will be. All of the other portions of that pie chart on the left are the individual programs that are funded for direct services to injured workers and employers of injured workers through the workers' benefit program. And John Schiltz will be going over those in more detail in his discussion of the workers' compensation division. On page 4, we have the various revenue sources, and as Corey indicated, our revenues are statutorily dedicated revenues, and these are the monies that come in to fund the various programs, both limited and non-limited.
But I'd like to give you a perspective of how we approach our management and budget development philosophy, so you have a perspective of how those numbers are built. We develop what we feel is the most efficient and effective business model to achieve the regulatory and, in some cases, the service delivery requirements that have been mandated by the legislature. Then we determine what the costs are to support that business model through the budget process, and we request your approval for those expenditures. And we establish a fee structure that's designed so that the regulatory costs of the programs are borne by those we regulate. And then finally, on a broader perspective, we manage the department's finances over a five-year forecast horizon, which aim to maintain prudent financial reserves to minimize the volatility of fees and assessment charges. Now, that said, there are a few slices on this page that don't really fit that model, and I'd like to point those out explicitly. You'll see at the top right insurance taxes. And those are actually retaliatory taxes that are paid by out-of-state insurance companies, and those revenues come through us but go directly to the general fund. And then down at the bottom of that pie chart, you'll notice a small portion that says fire marshal fees, and those fees are actually collected from homeowner insurance policy surcharges, and they're transferred to the fire marshal's budget for cost of their program. The last pie chart in this section really gives you a feel for representing the budget expenditures by category, both non-limited and limited. And oftentimes people believe that staff are the biggest piece of the pie on expenditures. But this really does show you that those benefits that accrue to OMIP insurance enrollees and the Worker Benefit Fund, those direct service benefits to Oregonians, take up the biggest portion of our overall budget, both non-limited and limited, and then come personal services and services and supplies. And we hope that this gives you a perspective so that as we speak to each one of the divisions, you have an appreciation for the relationship of both the non-limited and the limited portions and the piece of the pie that applies to each of the divisions that we'll be talking about.
Can you share with us once again on the special payments? You mentioned three areas where those payments go.
The special payments go to the insurance benefits for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool insureds. And then they also go, the next portion and the smaller portion go to fund the various programs within the Workers' Benefit Fund.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, also, I have a question about the insurance taxes, $124.2 million. I mean, that's not chump change. Is that something that is increasing? Is that staying flat?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, those fees or taxes are retaliatory taxes. And so and the basis of those retaliatory taxes are that if another state assesses a tax on an Oregon insurance company that does business in that state, we merely assess a retaliatory tax in the same amount to those insurers from that state that do business in Oregon. And I can actually get you the information on the changes in that over time, but as far as a control factor, it's really the decision of another state's taxing decisions that affect those insurers that do business in Oregon that are from that state.
Okay, one final follow-up.
Please follow up.
When will, in the course of the next 4 days, will we hear about something as small as the fire marshal situation, but still I have a couple questions on that. When does that fit into the presentation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, actually, it wouldn't normally fit into the presentation because we're kind of a middle party in a transaction that, because we do business with insurance companies, we regulate insurers, and we have the records, obviously, of all the insurance that is written. They actually pay to us the surcharge that they collect from the insured, those people they insure, on the homeowner insurance policies. That surcharge comes to us, and we just manage the flow of that from those insurance companies and pay it to the fire marshal. So
their budget actually is under public safety then, is that right?
Yes, I believe it is.
Okay, thank you.
Please continue.
Okay, well, that gives us that overall perspective, and the next thing that we would intend to do is move right into the division presentations. In the first instance, I'd like to take the opportunity to give a brief introduction to the workers' compensation system. And that might seem unusual initially, but what we want to do is basically recognize that there are a number of different organizational units within DCBS that actually provide delivery of services in support of that. And as Corey had indicated, some of the prime missions of the workers' compensation system is to prevent or reduce worker injuries and illnesses, and to ensure that subject workers do have workers' compensation coverage, and that if a worker is injured, that they receive the medical treatment and benefits that are necessary to get them back to work quickly. And then there's also a piece that deals with the resolution of disputes and the concern that when they occur, they are handled timely and fairly. And so, since these are organizationally different within DCBS, I just basically want at the phase one level to introduce those sections, and then each of the division administrators and the board chair will give a little more detailed discussion of what they do. Certainly, the prevention side of that mission is executed by our Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division, where they advance workplace safety and health. The Workers' Compensation Division focuses their efforts ensuring a balance in the system, administrative and regulatory, from the regulatory perspective, as well as education and enforcement. And one of their large focus areas, as we indicated earlier, is assuring that Oregon employers, their subject employers, are providing workers' compensation insurance, and that the benefits that accrue to injured workers are timely and accurately paid. The Workers' Compensation Board focuses on the element of the timely and impartial resolution of disputes. And each of these functions serves to protect the essential public interest of the system at a minimum cost of regulation, administration, and adjudication.
Approximately how many claims are handled each year within the Workers' Compensation Board, with the Workers' Compensation Board? Just ballpark.
Mr. Chair, John Schiltz will be coming up, it's disputes or claims? I'm sorry.
I'm reading this, and it says the Workers' Compensation Board is appointed by the governor to resolve workers' compensation claim and health and safety citation.
Okay, the claims that are heard by the board.
Yeah.
Maureen Bach, the chair of the board, will be up, and my guess is that she will have that information. If she doesn't, we'd be happy to get it to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'll continue. Now, I didn't mention two offices within the Department of Consumer Business Services that are part of this system, and they're the Ombudsman for Injured Workers and the Small Business Ombudsman. And their focus includes services that inform workers and investigate issues to resolve complaints, and those are primarily the functions of the the Ombudsman for Injured Workers. They serve as a voice for the concerns and interests of those injured workers, and they collaborate with other elements of the system within DCBS and also externally with insurers to assure that those issues and concerns are dealt with and hopefully are more responsive to the needs of both workers and employers. They'll deal with disputed claims to assure that an injured worker calling that office understands the nature of the process and what the appeal process is. They assist in obtaining the medical and disability benefits due workers, and they communicate to solve the problems at a level that doesn't take them to the board that we were just speaking of earlier. They also work with the Workers' Compensation Division and the Management Labor Advisory Committee and others to resolve high-level issues within the system. The Small Business Ombudsman provides workers' compensation information and assistance to employers, insurers, and trade groups. Their primary goal is to ensure that small businesses are able to provide insurance coverage for their workers, and they also support those businesses in navigating through a fairly sophisticated and complex system. So they'll assist workers in finding coverage if they're having difficulty. And oftentimes, once they've found coverage, there can be issues about how their employees may be classified, and they'll assist those small employers in dealing with classification issues. Both of these ombudsman offices report directly to the director so that they may be independent and provide advice to her, and they also provide recommendations to policymakers and the governor. So that gives a summary of how the pieces of the workers' compensation system within DCBS, and now we would go to each of those divisions and start out with the OROSHA, Mr. DeLuca, and then the Workers' Compensation Division, Mr. Schultz, and then the Workers' Compensation Board, Maureen Bach, the chair. If there aren't any questions, I'll leave the floor. Thank you.
No. Thank you. So we have Peter come over. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I am Peter DeLuca. I'm the administrator of Oregon OSHA, also known as the Occupational Safety and Health Division. And as you've heard, the quick and dirty on our mission is to improve, enhance workplace safety and health for all people working in the state of Oregon. OSHA itself is a federal program. It was created by the federal government. There are 26 states in the nation which run their own OSHA plans, and part of the Federal Act allows for that. The Federal Act says that as long as a state maintains a plan which is at least as effective as the Federal Act or the federal plan, then we will continue to do that. They provide us with 30% of our funding, so 30% of our budget is federal funding, and the other 70% is dedicated to state funds. I think the hallmark of what we do is a collaboration with business and labor.
Question.
Representative Richardson.
Would you clarify what you said? How many states do not opt to have their own OSHA under a waiver?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, there are 26 states that do have that do run their own OSHA programs, so that would be 24 that don't.
Okay. If we get a 30% match, if we have our own, how is it funded for those 24 states that do not have their own department but just rely on federal OSHA?
The federal government sends in people and funds that.
100% federal money?
Yes.
Okay, so follow up.
Please follow up.
So I guess as we go through this, we need to just look at the 70% that we're putting in and ensure that we're getting so much better work that we would otherwise use that 70% someplace else.
Well, I can tell you that you are getting much better work from us because, number one, we have greater resources.
You mean taxpayers?
Pardon me?
Greater resources.
Well, we have greater resources in terms of what we have available to help employers. Typically.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, the OSHA, the non-federal portion of the OSHA funding, maybe what you're asking about, you may want to cover where the non-federal portion comes from.
The non-federal portion comes out of the workers' compensation system. It is based upon that it's a percentage of pure premium for workers' compensation that goes into this system to fund the programs within the system. So this isn't general funds, and it doesn't come from the taxpayers. And I get up every morning and thank my lucky stars that we're not competing with school children for the funds to run the program. It's paid for by the businesses who use our services.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Abakian.
If it's relevant to the issue, too, perhaps you can talk about the value of the estate maintaining some of its autonomy and not having yet one other federal administration in our state managing our affairs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abakian, I think your point is very well made. The fact of the matter
I did kind of make it without lead you into it, didn't I? But for the record, I'd rather have you say it than me.
Here's a big softball. Absolutely. We are in a position in the state of Oregon to look at what the federal government does and to decide whether that's good for Oregon or decide whether we're going to go a different way. Now, we do have to be at least as effective as the federal government, but let me give you one example. Of course, you're all familiar with the way we log in Oregon. We've got high mountains, steep gullies. Our timber is on a vertical plane rather than a horizontal plane. And so we string up these cables and run them back and forth across empty spaces. And it creates all kinds of hazards in Oregon that we don't see in the federal states, because the federal states have taken their logging regulations from the way they do their logging in the Carolinas, which is primarily flat, where they cut down the trees and drive up with a bulldozer and throw a cable around the stuff and drag it out of the forest. Our logging standard is very different from the federal standard. It's a model not only for the Northwest, and many of the states up here have adopted our logging standard or something very similar. It's also a model for the world. We've had inquiries all over the world about how we do our regulation of logging here in the state of Oregon. If we were a federal state, we'd simply have the North Carolina standard, and we wouldn't be able to devise our own standard. And there are numerous examples of where we have gone our own way and devised our own standards. And what we will do, what I was going to talk about in terms of the collaboration, this really comes back to what I was saying, is before we do a standard, we will work with the industry and work with labor and put together a group of people to study the matter and come up with a solution that works for everybody. And because we believe if it doesn't work for business and for labor, and if it isn't something that government can sign off on, then it's not going to work for anybody. So we are able to put together local focus groups and work on local issues in that way. If we were simply a federal state, then what we would have is federal government comes in and says, here's how we do it, and here's how you do it. And
Mr. DeLuca, let me ask you a question. Have you done any customer satisfaction surveys?
Mr. Chairman, we do customer satisfaction surveys on both our consultations and our enforcement visits that we do.
Would it be possible to get a copy
Absolutely.
Of the results of those, and perhaps we could pass it to all the members?
And what's really interesting there is our satisfaction on our enforcement visits is higher even than it is on the consultation visits.
Look forward to seeing it.
The consultation visits, of course, are visits where a business calls us and asks us for help. And we will send experts into that business to work with the business and help the business become better. enforcement visits, we get people off of a list that we generate, which is primarily driven by the number of claims that they've had in their workplace. And we send compliance officers in to inspect and make sure that their processes are correct and that their workplaces are safe. But we do get higher satisfaction ratings from our enforcement visits than we do from our consultations. Not significantly higher. They're both well above 80%. So,
thank you.
Well, let me talk a little bit about the organizational structure. We have about 230 employees. Our largest segment is enforcement, where we have 80 compliance officers. Second largest is consultation, which provides that free help to anybody who wants it. 36 consultants do that. We have 10 people who do nothing but training in our training section. And on any given workday in the state of Oregon, we have at least two training events going on average. We have 7 technical specialists in our technical section. Their job is rule development and interpretation. We have a major events section which plans training events where we can gather lots and lots and lots of people, not the least of which is going to be held in March, where we will fill the Oregon Convention Center with 3,000 people interested in health and safety for an entire week of training events where they can go and learn all kinds of different aspects of safety and health.
Not mean to interrupt, but that struck a chord with me. Would you please send me information on that?
I'd be more than happy to, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
Our entire committee. Thank you.
And we have a resource center, which is a lending library, having resources in the basement of the Labor and Industries Building, open to the public and for use by the public, any resources they might need. Our program impact, of course, you know that our top priority is reduction of injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. That's the top priority of anybody in this kind of business. But our number one goal in terms of getting there is employer self-sufficiency. We do this through consultation, through working with businesses. We also do it to a large extent through enforcement. And we have said over and over again that we want every one of our enforcement visits to be a learning experience for that employer. We want to be able to say that when we've left the workplace, even on an enforcement visit, that we've left something behind which is of value to that employer. And that's, I think, reflected in the survey results that we get. We have a couple of programs which recognize employers that have excellent safety programs. One is our SHARP program. SHARP stands for Safety and Health Achievement and Recognition Program. We started that 5 years ago, and we said, you know, we'd like to get 20 employers in this program in the first 5 years. We have, in the first 5 years, 88 employers in Oregon that are members of this SHARP alliance. And we have another number just about that big in the pipeline of people who are working toward it. So that has been a very, very successful program. And the other one of the programs that we have recognizing employers that are really doing it right represents or recognizes the very best of the best. It's called the Voluntary Protection Plan. And we have 7 employers in the state that are Voluntary Protection Plan members. Senator Verger, you went to one of our celebrations down on the coast.
Oh, I did.
And these are really big deals. I mean, they shut down the plant. They serve everybody lunch. There are speeches. A lot of congratulatory. We hang a flag up for them. And this is a very, very big deal. It's a national program. And
Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, I'd like to just say to you that what I have found is the pride that it gives the employees. There is a spirit at the celebration that is unique to most of the celebrations that I go to, and I wanted to express that to you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, you're absolutely correct, and I think that what you also find is they take that pride into the workplace, and they're more productive, and they're safer, and it all inures to the benefit of the employer and to the employees, because there are more people going home at the end of every day in the same condition that they came to work in the morning, and that's what we're all about. Of course, as Mr. Malkasian told you, we're part of the workers' comp system, and our goal of safety, good safety, It helps employers save money. It lowers workers' compensation rates. In fact, in the past several years since 1990, we have been able to demonstrate $10.1 billion in workers' compensation premium reductions alone, saved by Oregon businesses because of the reduction in injuries and illnesses and fatalities in workplaces. Of course, the best part of it is that it protects workers, sends them home at the end of the day the way they came to work in the morning. Our accepted disability claims rate is down 28% in the last 10 years, and fatalities, which are program-related, which are those fatalities caused by something that happened in the workplace. It doesn't include things like heart attacks, but it includes the things where people are fatally injured. Fatalities in the last 10 years are down by about 50%. So our record is continuously improving safety. If you take a look at page 2 on the executive summary in your materials, you'll see a couple of graphs that I'm not going to go through in detail, but it gives you a pretty good idea of how the numbers of injuries, illnesses, and fatalities have just been coming down and down and down over the years, and it's really working well. The activities that we do to support this downward trend, last biennium, when we were at the legislature, we said we'd do about 5,000 inspections a year, and that's about what we do. We said between 2,000 and 2,500 consultations a year, recognizing that we've got about half the number of people doing that kind of work, and that's what we do. Lots and lots of training. In 2003, we trained 26,000 employees. In 2004, we trained 19,000. Now, the difference is that some of the major training events that we hold only occur in odd-numbered years. So some years we train more than others, but that's pretty consistent, and it has been for a number of years. And all of this, of course, continues that downward trend of injuries, accidents, and fatalities.
Quick question, Mr. DeLuca. Share with us really quick the level of experience, level of education of an inspector. Give me a typical inspector's background.
Mr. Chairman, we have... I can give you a couple of scenarios because there are different kinds of people doing different kinds of work. We hire numbers of people out of industry. So we have a number of people who learned their craft on the job. Some of them learned it as a worker. Some of them learned it as moving into the safety department within that particular industry, and then we get a hold of them and we give them training and training and training so that they understand not only the industry from whence they came but also numerous other industries as well. And that would be probably a fairly typical way that we get and train a safety compliance officer, although frankly we're seeing more and more of those people coming out of college. Health compliance officers are a little bit different. Health compliance officers are industrial hygienists, and most of our industrial hygienists have some college education. Some have lots of college education, and we have at least one that's a PhD. So those people come out of programs like they have at Oregon State. They come out of areas like the United States Air Force, which trains an awful lot of industrial hygienists, and they come to us very highly trained.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I was going to say that this ties into the DCBS mission of protecting workers and helping businesses. We've had a couple of streamlining projects in the past 2 years, the most notable of which is what we call our core rules. Typically, a new business or any other business for that matter, a small business in a non-high hazard type of an industry, would have to go through reams and reams and reams of rules in order to understand everything that they need to comply with. We have taken those and compiled them down into about a 50-page booklet that if you are a small business and if you are in not a high-hazard occupation and if you comply with what we are suggesting in that book of core rules, you'll be pretty much up to snuff in terms of everything you need to be if an OSHA inspector might come to the door.
Let me ask a question on that. We have 19 small business development centers. If I called one randomly, would they have that book on their shelf?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I can find out.
Let me
I wouldn't.
Up.
I would frankly be surprised if they didn't. But I don't know. It's very recent that we finished the project, so it may be that it hasn't gotten out to them yet.
Will you make sure they do?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, that pretty much covers it. We do tie in, of course, to the governor's principles for Oregon, a positive business climate, and keeping Oregonians safe. And everything we do is looking at that triple bottom line of reduction of injuries, illnesses, and fatalities.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Next, we have John Schiltz from the Workers' Compensation Division.
We're doing pretty good on time. You're pretty good at keeping us going. Come on up, John. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm John Schiltz with the Workers' Compensation Division. It is my pleasure to be here today to talk to you about the Workers' Compensation Division. You just heard from Pete DeLuca talking about preventing people from getting hurt on the job, and that's an extremely important aspect of the workers' compensation system. What we do is the next step. When individuals do get hurt on the job or if they have an occupational disease, then we get involved. What I'm going to tell you about today and give you an overview on is our mission and programs, some of our accomplishments, our objectives in going forward into the next biennium, as well as some of our key performance measures and the results that we're measuring on that. Our mission is to efficiently and impartially enforce the workers' compensation law. The statute does lay out what the policy objectives are for workers' compensation in Oregon, and I think those are worth talking about just briefly. They are to restore the injured worker physically and economically to a self-sufficient status expeditiously and to the greatest extent possible. The objective is also to ensure a fair and just administrative system for the delivery of medical and financial benefits to injured workers. We are also charged with resolving disputes quickly and fairly, as well as ensuring that subject employers obtain and provide workers' compensation coverage for their employees, which you've heard something about earlier today. Our program delivery to achieve these objectives are as follows. We do spend quite a bit of time investigating to ensure that employers maintain workers' compensation insurance coverage, and that includes actually tracking all employers' cancellation of coverage and following up with them to inquire, are you sure you really want to do this, and asking some questions to make sure that that's the right thing to do. Sometimes this is a confusing system, and most of the time, in fact, the vast majority of the time, the employers are making the right choice, but we're just trying to help employers from falling into a non-complying situation, and we do pick up some employers that probably shouldn't have canceled their insurance. We resolve medical, vocational, disability, and other disputes via alternative dispute resolution. In fact, in the last calendar year, we resolved over 5,700 disputes inside the division, either through letters of agreement or actual orders that we wrote. We reimburse insurers and employers for expenditures that they're eligible for reimbursement from the Workers' Benefit Fund. Greg talked about a couple of these earlier and just some examples. One is the Retroactive Reserve Program, where we do over $60 million worth of reimbursement typically a year. That program is set up to help provide additional benefits for beneficiaries or injured workers themselves who are injured under previous benefit schedules that are no longer sufficient for them to cover their income needs. And so the Worker Benefit Fund actually subsidizes those income replacement benefits for workers who have been permanently and totally disabled or who were killed on the job and their beneficiaries are still dependent on that income.
John, I'm going to interrupt you really quick. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Schultz, you mentioned there's 5,700 disputes that were resolved. Was that within a one-year period?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, that was in calendar year 2004.
Okay, can I follow up with a couple?
Please, follow up.
Can you give us, and maybe you did, and I just didn't catch it, but the total number of claims just roughly that you deal with a year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, there are approximately 100,000 claims filed every year in Oregon. The vast majority of those claims are what we call medical-only claims. In other words, they're not serious claims. They're typically for medical services only, get a foreign body out of the eye, stitches or something like that, and the worker goes right back to work. But we also have approximately about 21,000 to 23,000 depending on the year, disabling claims where a worker is actually unable to go back to work for a period of time. Is that responsive to your question, Representative?
Please follow up.
The 21,000 is out of the 100,000? Is that what you're saying, or is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that is true, yes.
Okay, so you have roughly about a 5.7% dispute. I assume that we're saying is there's 100,000 claims and 5,700 of them don't just get resolved, but they go on to the next level. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, that's at least partially correct. There are disputes for different reasons. The disputes that we get involved in terms of alternative dispute resolution, are disputes around benefit provision. There are also disputes in regard to whether the claim should be accepted or denied. Those disputes go to the Workers' Compensation Board instead of to us. The disputes we're dealing with are actually around provision of specific benefits, such as is the worker eligible for vocational rehabilitation? Is the medical services that are being provided appropriate?
One follow-up.
Please.
Do you do any surveying as far as client satisfaction for 100,000 people that filed claims?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, we do. In 2004, we conducted 16 customer satisfaction surveys regarding various programs within the division. In addition to that, we did 8 more surveys last year to just gather information on components of the workers' compensation system. So we've surveyed about the satisfaction level that injured workers and employers and other stakeholders to the system have with our programs, as well as satisfaction with components of the entire system at large. For example, we did a quite a large survey in regard to required medical examinations, or they're often called IMEs in the system.
Okay, and one last question.
I just wondered, I'm glad that you do that, but is there access to the results of those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, yes, we can provide you with the results of those surveys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Sandra Berger.
Thank you. Mr. Shields, as a business person, I really appreciate Workman's Comp and our employees do, and we have very few claims. You can probably look at our record. I'm not sure we have had any. But as a legislator, I get a letter about once a month from someone, and the letter is a very sad letter. It's very convincing. It will be from someone from my district or maybe not. And I was looking at I think you have 10 ombudsmen. And I just wonder if in the process there's some way, most of the people that write to me have already been through the process and have been denied benefits or denied the claim. And I need direction, and you maybe don't want to do it in this format, but I need direction as to the best way for me to handle my constituents that is sensitive and appropriate, and also that blends in with your process. And so I would ask you at some point to give us some assistance in that.
I'm going to, Senator Berger, I'm going to take the prerogative and add to that, Madam Director. That would be an excellent opportunity for your agency to assist the legislators, not only on this committee, but in this entire building on that issue, because I think every one of us has to deal with that, and perhaps that would be a great lunch forum at some point where we could come in and get a little 101 on how to handle that issue.
Mr. Chair, we would be happy to do that. We do work with individual legislators on responding to constituent concerns and requests on a regular basis, but we would be happy to share what the resources are, how we can help.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Virgil, for that question. We also, in terms of program delivery, ensure that workers receive accurate and timely benefits through education, audit, consultation, and investigation. We actually have quite a large audit presence here in Oregon. For example, in 2004, we conducted 470 separate audits on over 10,000 claims. The point in most of those audits are, again, to ensure that workers are receiving the benefits that they're supposed to receive. They get those benefits on a timely basis when they're supposed to get them and accurately. An example of a result here in Oregon, the timeliness of first payment, for example, on a time loss check for Oregon workers is typically well over 90%. A study that was done, it's a few years old now, it's actually about 4 years old in the state of Washington, showed in the same area the timeliness of the first payment was about 12%. So Oregon typically enjoys very high levels of compliance in benefit provision. We also, as was noted earlier, facilitate early return to work for injured workers by offering incentive programs to employers. Mr. Chair, you mentioned that you would like some information in regard to the Small Business Development Centers. We'll provide this in that response, but I just wanted to mention that we do work directly with the Small Business Development Centers, have been doing so here recently, to provide them education on our reemployment programs so that their employers know how to take advantage of those programs. There are some nice programs here in Oregon for employers in terms of being able to reemploy their injured workers and defray some of the cost of providing modified or light duty employment for them.
Let me follow up on that question. When those folks, how are those folks coming, being referred to the SBDCs? Tell me the process. Are they coming to you and you folks are sending them to the SBDC, to the Small Business Development Center?
Mr. Chair, at this time, what we are doing is going out to the Small Business Development Centers themselves and educating that staff on the programs that we offer.
Have you been to any Eastern Oregon SBDCs?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe we have yet. I think we've just been in the Willamette Valley so far, but the plan is to cover the entire state.
Thank you.
Some accomplishments for the last biennium. One, and I'll repeat some of the things that have been mentioned before, but I hopefully not bore you. Employers here in the state of Oregon continue to pay very low workers' compensation rates. The average workers' compensation pure premium rate has been reduced or has remained the same over the last 15 years in Oregon. There's no other state in the nation that can say that. There's been, as Pete pointed out, $10.1 billion in savings to Oregon employers. We went from the sixth most expensive state in the nation in 1986 to the 42nd most expensive state in the nation in 2004. While we have lowered the cost for employers, we have increased worker benefits. Between fiscal years 1987 and 2004, permanent partial disability benefits, which are benefits that are paid to workers who are permanently disabled, it's a part of the compensation, permanently disabled from their injury, have increased between 347% to 407%, depending on the type of disability that the worker has. Temporary disability benefits, which is the wage loss replacement, have increased from a maximum rate of 100% of the state average weekly wage to 133% of the state average weekly wage. In addition, we now compensate workers for loss of income from multiple jobs when before Oregon only compensated for loss of income from the job at injury. About 9% of our workforce work in multiple jobs, and if they're disabled from one job, they're often disabled from all of their jobs. I pointed out we have some successful return to work programs. The employment rate in Oregon in 2004 for workers who use our return to work programs was...
In addition to the numbers you just cited, though, I'm guessing, and tell me if I'm wrong, that your total cost per claim has gone down since the reforms of the mid-90s, and that's the reason for the decrease in premiums, correct?
Vice Chair, a representative of Akian, actually the total cost per claim since the reform has actually remained rather consistent. As Mr. DeLuca pointed out, a larger reason for the decrease in the pure premium rate has been the dropping frequency of injuries here in Oregon. That has been the main driver.
One more. And could, have you got any numbers at the top of your head regarding the number of claims filed, and if they've gone down, why they've gone down? Maybe there's reasons other than fewer injuries, and the acceptance rate of claims that are filed, since now there's a higher standard for getting claims accepted.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, acceptance rate here in Oregon has been running at about 84% consistently for about the last last 5 or 6 years.
Right.
And I'm sorry, I just blanked out on your first question. Could I ask you to repeat that, please?
You've given us the impression, which I think there's a lot of truth to, that your department has done a good job in increasing safety on the job for folks. Maybe that's had an effect in decreasing workplace injuries. Mm. However, what information do you have that people are simply not filing claims anymore because the standards for getting claims accepted through the Workers' Comp Division are higher because of the reforms in the 90s, and that might skew the results of what you're telling us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, you're making a very good point. There are two things that I would point out in that realm. One is that the standard of causation that a worker must meet is now much higher, as you pointed out. We have a major contributing cause standard now in Oregon, whereas before it was a material contributing cause standard. And so what that means is that work must be the major contributing cause for the worker's need for treatment or their disability, and no longer needs to just be a cause. And so that is a higher causation standard to meet. We also have some evidence through Bureau of Labor research that workers are not filing as many claims after seeking treatment as they had in previous years. There could be lots of reasons for that. One, I think, would have to be the worker's expectation about what's going to result from that claim filing.
Meaning fear from retaliation by the employer? Excuse me. I don't know what you mean by that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Avakian, I have no evidence to support that would be the case, but I think that workers in today's workers' compensation system are much less likely to miss time from work because of their injury. Most employers and physicians are promoting early return to work for workers, so it's highly likely they're going to go right back to work after an injury. Also, I think it is much, I don't know how else to say this other than to say I think it is culturally much less accepted to file a workers' compensation claim today than it was 20 years ago.
Here's where we are. We have 35 more minutes. Jan, we're going to need you to go through and wrap up in the next probably 10 minutes, if you could.
Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you.
We also look at the amount of litigation that is going on in the workers' compensation system, and we have been very successful here in Oregon in reducing litigation, and there are many reasons why that could be the case. One reason that I pointed out before is that we do provide alternative or administrative dispute resolution through the workers' compensation system. There are three areas that we are looking at. These are large areas for making some adjustment through the public policy forum in the next session. One is, and I just want to touch on these, and we'll come back and provide more detail, or I can answer questions today. We are making recommendations for changes in terms of permanent total disability, insurer or independent medical examinations, as well as return to work programs. Permanent and total disability would propose a redefinition of what gainful employment is, as well as put limits on rescinding permanent and total disability benefits. The return to work programs, the idea there is to expand benefits and access to those programs. Insurer or independent medical examinations, that one is still being debated. And the idea is to try to ensure more objective examinations. We have developed a customer service policy, and I did note that part of that, I did note that we're doing customer satisfaction surveys. That's a big part of that customer service policy for us. We want to find out from our customers what is of high importance to them and how well we are doing in those areas. And if we get a response where the customers are telling us this is something that's very important to us and the satisfaction is low, that then presents us with opportunities to go in and look at our programs and do process improvement and try to raise the satisfaction level there. We have been involved in regulatory streamlining, and it's been based on feedback from our customers as well. And just a couple of examples I want to bring up. We've enhanced our website. For example, we've got a contested case reporter database now for attorneys, more comprehensive information for injured workers, a rule history section by rule number, insurance coverage database so people can look up the employer's workers' compensation carrier. We have electronic reporting of coverage now available for employers. 30% of our coverage is now coming in through electronic means rather than paper. We've also provided self-insured employers the ability to file their surety requirements through a letter of credit, which was in response to the post-9/11 era when the surety bond market became extremely expensive. Anticipated results, things that we're going to try to achieve going forward, is we want to continue to help injured workers return to work promptly and at a wage that's closest possible to the wage they were making before they got hurt. We want to continue to provide excellent customer service through resolving disputes and issuing our decisions and orders in a timely manner with no dip in quality. We want to continue to provide rapid access to information to you, the policymakers, and the public. We want to enforce laws requiring employers to provide workers' compensation coverage, which can be somewhat of a more difficult task when times are tougher. We want to continue to streamline our programs. And we want to turn our attention to electronic reporting of claims now that we have our coverage online. Some key performance measures that I'll hit pretty quickly that we look at is the number of claims against employers who do not have workers' compensation insurance coverage. And it's a rate. It's how many claims do we have per every 1,000 claims that are filed. And you can look on in the WCD section didn't write the page number down very quickly. Page 4, about how we're doing on this. You can see that actually the rate has gone up over the last 3 years, which is something that we don't like to see. This is something, however, that where we get into a recessionary cycle, we do see. Over the last 10 years, however, the rate has varied between 1.4 and 9.7, and the average is 4.6. So you can see in the last 2 years, we've been very close to the average rate. We also take a look at the percentage of injured workers who receive timely and accurate benefits. This is on page 5 of the WCD presentation. Timeliness of benefits has been right around the high 80s, and in the last year that we measured, 2003, it was at 90.6. Benefit payments paid accurately have varied right around the 90% range. They were at 92.6% recently. And another area that goes more towards exactly what we do versus the people that we regulate, preferred worker requests reviewed timely. This is something that I thought needed a tremendous amount of improvement. When I stepped into this role 4 years ago, we were at 52.6%. We've raised that now to 80.3%, and I would very much like to come back in a couple of years and say we're now well over 90%. Another area that we look at is the difference in percentage of eligible workers who return to work. Is there a question?
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Morris.
A question with respect to the timely payment of benefits. When does the clock start to determine what's timely? The point of injury or the point of final resolution of whether it's an on-the-job or off-the-job injury?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, it depends on the benefit that we're measuring. For example, if it's the first payment that may be due in terms of time loss benefits or wage replacement benefits, the clock actually starts ticking by law on the employer's date of knowledge.
And is the 801?
It's the day that the employer was told or would reasonably be expected to know that the worker has suffered an on-the-job injury. And within 14 days of that date, the first time loss payment must be made unless the claim has been denied. Medical benefits paid. The insurance company or the self-insured employer must make that payment within 45 days of receipt of the medical bill. And it varies depending on the type of benefit we're talking about.
Thank you.
I've already provided you how we are doing in terms of the return to work programs on page. Let's see, I get this. I didn't write that down. I'm sorry. On page 6 of our WCD presentation, you can see the actual differences between workers who use our programs versus those who don't. We look at both rate of return to work as well as wage recovery, and there is a significant difference between workers who use the programs and those who don't in terms of both the rate of going back to work as well as the wages that they are able to recapture when returning to work. Another area that's very important is timely resolution of disputes and issues and issuance of orders. As I noted before, we are engaged in a lot of dispute resolution, over 5,700 in the last year, and we are timely in 89% of those orders and disputes. Some of that, in terms of timeliness, is directed by statute, and some of that are self-imposed standards that we have imposed upon ourselves if the statute doesn't specify one. And then finally, I did want to talk about one more, which is DCBS Measure 14. It's actually on page 17 in the appendix, and that's the percentage of worker benefit fund expenditures determined to be where the expenditure is determined to be eligible. This is a fairly tricky measure, in my opinion, because this measure demonstrates the clarity of WCD rules and procedures that enable insurers and employers to access eligible benefits from the worker benefit fund. This is important to workers because the worker is often using these funds to sell themselves back to employers when it's a reemployment issue. And if we're stalling or not being timely or finding that employers are not doing it right and then holding back the funds, it's not helping workers. What we're trying to hit here is a balance. We don't want to have this program be giveaway where we just every expenditure that goes out, we go out and say, yes, that was done right. But on the other hand, we want to make our rules and procedures clear and easy so that employers are having success accessing those funds because that's what they're there for. In 2003, we were right at 95%. 2004, 95.3% in terms of expenditures that we determined the employer was eligible to receive, or the insurance company.
I'm going to be cutting you off here.
Yeah, I was at the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
It was very good. I have one question. If I'm a sole proprietor, or my wife and I are a partnership, how do I know whether or not I should apply for workers' compensation insurance?
Mr. Chair, you can always call and ask us directly, and we would help walk you through whether or not you would require workers' compensation insurance.
Is there any, let me play on this a little bit. When someone registers an assumed business name with the Secretary of State's office, is there any notification to them letting them know that this service may be required of them?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure about that, and I'd like to get back to you with that.
The one thing
I believe there is, but I'm not totally sure.
The one thing I want to point out to this committee is, economic development comes in many, many forms, and one of the things I want to explore this session is looking at the sole proprietor and the husband and wife, mom and pop, partnerships, and trying to figure out how to help them take their business to the next level. And I truly, truly would contend that one of the biggest hurdles of stimulating small business in Oregon is folks simply do not understand payroll. They have no clue, they're afraid of it, and by golly, they're going to avoid it to the end. And so often they end up missing opportunities or getting themselves in trouble simply because of that lack of education. And I've talked with the deputy, and we're going to further discuss this, and I'd love to follow up on this with you. So thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you. That is a very big disincentive, and I would look forward to our discussion.
Thank you. Who do we have next here? Maureen.
Maureen Bach.
Yeah. Good afternoon. We've eliminated your time down to about 23 minutes. Is that going to be sufficient?
I think so, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Maureen Bach. I am the chair of the Workers' Compensation Board. And I think last time I appeared in front of you, I took all of 5 minutes. So,
oh, good.
As you've heard in the other presentations, the need for dispute resolution is inevitable in the workers' compensation system because there is a certain number of claims that are denied. And these are disputes that come to us, and they are disputes between claimants and insurer or self-insured employer who has denied the claim generally. The Workers' Compensation Board is an independent agency, as Corey noted, which shares services with DCBS. And we share those services with DCBS because that allows us to really focus on our core mission, which is to provide timely and impartial dispute resolution for the parties that appear before us. Mr. Chair, you asked about the number of disputes that we hear every year. We actually hear far fewer than the number of requests we receive, but we have a statutory mandate to set requests for hearing within 90 days after we receive that request for a hearing, and we receive about 10,000 of those a year. Once a dispute goes through our hearings division and is heard by an administrative law judge, either party then can take an appeal to the board. So those are the two divisions we have that actually provide service to the public. We hold our hearings at a number of staffed and unstaffed offices throughout the state of Oregon. Last biennium, we refined our docketing process so we could really travel to places where we needed to hold hearings. So we travel to places like Ontario, Coose Bay, Pendleton, and some other outlying areas so we can provide service in those communities. Board Review Division provides its service here in Salem, and we, as board members, sit in panels and conduct de novo review of the record that is developed at the hearings division level. We contribute to the DCBS performance measures on timeliness because we do have several statutory mandates, one being to set cases within the 90 days of the request for hearing being filed with us. The other is to issue an opinion and order out of hearings division within 30 days after record closure. And so those are composite measures that roll up into the DCPS measures. We also have one specific performance measure that is related to the board, and that is on page 2 of your appendix. We see that as a customer service measure, and it measures how frequently the board is affirmed when an appeal is taken to the Court of Appeals out of Board Review Division. It recognizes the importance to the people in the system to get their dispute resolved with facts that are substantially supported by what's in the record, and to impartially apply the law as it is written. And we take that statutory construct very seriously at the Board Review Division. When the board members are sitting to resolve those cases, they do sit in panels with different backgrounded members, and I not only run the agency, but I have the distinct pleasure of being the tie-breaking member on those cases, so that I have two hats when I'm doing that. But we think that getting it right at Board Review Division is a very important part of what we do, and that is why we have that performance measure in place, to see how the court views our performance, essentially. With that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Quick question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
What percent of the time are you the tie-breaking vote?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, it has really varied depending on the other members and the number of cases that come before us. I find right now I'm the tie-breaking member in probably less than 20% of the cases.
And then is it fair to characterize the other 80% as unanimous?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, that would be true. We do set en banc with all five members on significant cases, and those would be cases of first impression that are likely to have what we see as a profound impact on the workers' compensation system. And those are published on our website as significant cases. It's a searchable website. But that's the only time we sit en banc, and there may be then some. I participate in those cases, not necessarily as a tiebreaker.
Maureen, this question may not be applicable, but have you folks determined the hourly cost of a hearing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, we have not done that. We have tracked the amount of time spent actually in the hearing room by our administrative law judges, and the ratio of the time in the hearing to the time taken to write an order is about 1 to 4. It's about 4 hours per hour in the hearing room. Hearings tend to take about 90 minutes. That's time on the record. That does not take into account the time that is spent in preliminary discussions where the parties may be trying to settle on the courthouse steps, if you will, or time spent, you know, taking a client or a witness to the woodshed, if you will.
Let me ask a follow-up question on that. Yesterday we had the Employment Department before us, and they have an administrative hearings office, and they were able to share with us what they saw as an hourly breakdown of their expenses. Have you folks had any conversations in the past of partnering with them, or has there been conversations about even a merger of the two?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there has not been. When the Office of Administrative Hearing was put into place, the board was excluded at that time because we already provided impartial dispute resolution as an independent forum. And at the time that the Office of Administrative Hearings was being considered, the concern was that agencies who were penalizing people they regulated were then hearing those cases and making decisions, and that was felt to be inappropriate, if you will. That has never been what we did. We were always in impartial resolving disputes between parties that we did not regulate. So I think just because the nature of the disputes were different, we were carved out at that time. We do share information with Office Administrative Hearings. For example, in 1998, the board adopted a code of conduct for its administrative law judges, and I shared that with the chief hearings officer for the panel, Mr. Ewing, and I believe that they used that as their basis for adopting their own code of conduct. So we do share information.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Any other questions? Well, committee members, we are ahead of schedule, 15 minutes. Truly appreciate the good work that you folks have done. The information has been excellent. We appreciate you sticking to the nominal amount of time we have. Robin, thank you for all that you've done in getting us prepared and keeping us on track. So with that said, we'll adjourn for the day.